This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Because of the coronavirus lockdown, we're recording all sorts of extra unannounced episodes, so please subscribe to this podcast now by going to reason.com/podcasts or Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, that way you won't miss a single show. Speaking of the coronavirus lockdown, one of the most promising ways to end the quarantine is to be able to know when we've been exposed to the coronavirus so we can go get tested or go into quarantine ourselves. One of the most promising ways to do that is through smartphone apps that will notify us automatically if we've made such contact with infected people. But these apps also pose serious questions about whether or not they'll work, and especially they raise concerns about privacy. Will they just become ways in which we can all be traced by authorities all the time for whatever reason, everywhere we go? My guest today says she and her crew at Stanford's COVID Watch Group have a solution. Tina White is a grad student working towards her PhD in mechanical engineering at Stanford, and she's the lead of a team that has built an app and is continuing to build out an app that she says is voluntary, effective, and respectful of privacy. Tina White, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hi, Nick. It's nice to meet you. I really appreciate being on Reason.
All right. Well, you know, why don't we start? Explain in general what these sorts of apps do. Obviously, there's been a lot of press about Apple and Google coming together to create the infrastructure for apps or tracing apps. What do tracing apps, you know, how do they work in general? And then after that, let's talk about some of the privacy concerns that they raise.
Yeah, that sounds good. So this all started quite a while ago for me, it started at the end of January when I first started seeing the news out of China and had some sleepless nights and was anxious about it coming here. I think that was already bad enough, or I had enough concerns already. And then I saw the China app that tracks people who might have the virus and is this very sort of very invasive authoritarian app. And that for me, I'm a libertarian, and it kind of felt like that's the last straw. I don't want to see that too, in addition to everything else that's going on. However,
and this, the app in China, I mean, it was mandatory. It was an automatic, I mean, everybody had to download it and it would follow you around. And what, like it, anytime you got close to people who had been infected, you would be notified or somebody would come to your door. How did the Chinese app work?
So there's several different apps out there now. So there's the Chinese app, there's similar ones in South Korea, there's something in Singapore. So the issue is that there's a lot of pressure to develop this kind of technology because of the fact that it helps, because it performs sort of automated contact tracing, and that's the thing that could stop the virus. So my concern was, oh gosh, there's going to be a lot of pressure for that to come here, to come to any other countries for good reasons. But there's a major risk of these sort of apps contributing to surveillance. So normally the way that it would work, and there are many different kinds of apps, so it's kind of hard to say they're all a little bit different. But the point is to either track where you are and then try to figure out if you've been exposed that way. And then there's sort of technology for tracking who you're near, and also collecting identifying information in order to then alert you later. So all of those methods could either collecting GPS data or collecting like Bluetooth data that's identifying can really contribute to like more surveillance capacity than even more than there's already sort of a level of surveillance that already exists. And these would be adding to that.
I mean, this is partly when we carry our cell phones around. I mean, there are GPS locators in each phone. So, you know, that are pinging off of towers and things like that. So we can, or law enforcement or the phone companies or whoever can trace really in to some pretty strong degree where we go all every day, right?
Right. So there's this current capacity that already exists. And then our goal as a team with the look and see if there's a way to still perform this kind of messaging and alert people, but without adding to what's already there. So that's how we got started, was looking into, so there's, what are the technologies that are even available? on smartphones. And there's just GPS and there's Bluetooth. We looked into MAC address logging and all sorts of the different options that were available. And is there a way to perform this either anonymously or in a very privacy preserving way? And that's how we got started sort of looking into different methods. And our team, early March, ran into another team that was using Bluetooth. And when we talked to them about how it worked, with Bluetooth, you don't collect location data. And location data, it was something that we had originally been looking at to try to figure out if there was a way to anonymize it or something to make it work, not collect GPS trajectories. But unfortunately, with GPS, trajectories are very identifying. Everybody's path through space is a little bit different. And it's very hard to anonymize that before leaving the phone. So we were pretty disappointed because we wanted to find some way to make that work with GPS, but couldn't, not in a way that we were satisfied with the privacy implications. So when we ran into this other team who talked about how Bluetooth could maybe use, you could use signal strength with Bluetooth to be as a kind of proxy for distance between the phones. And so you wouldn't be collecting location data, but just what's, is there another phone near me?
So, and that, I mean, what's interesting about that, and I'm, you know, one of the reasons I was very excited to talk with you is not simply because of the promise of the technology, but the promise that you would be able to explain the technology to me in a way that I finally fully understand, and you're starting to, or you are, so that's good. But the idea then is, I have my phone, I carry my phone wherever I go, and using, it could be GPS, but that's invasive for a lot of reasons, or it's much more identifying. Or I walk around with my Bluetooth on. You have your phone and your Bluetooth on. And there are the phones will generate kind of handshakes or so they know they've been in touch with each other. And then our data is somehow going up to a database where if one of us shows up as infected or says, hey, I was infected, we'll be able to go through a database to get in touch with everybody that we were near to say, hey, you were near, you might have been near somebody who has tested positive for COVID-19.
Yeah, so that's basically how it works. And let me, I can go into a little bit more detail about that.
Please.
So with Bluetooth, it's this sort of short, waves are sent out over a short distance. It's very much like sound, like somebody's, you can hear somebody if they're near you, and you can't hear somebody if they're very far away or on the other side of a wall. So signal strength with Bluetooth works in a very similar way. So if a phone is sending out a Bluetooth signal, then only the phones that are nearby can hear that. And that's one way that makes it kind of private because of the fact that message can be communicated directly between phones without a middleman. So like surveillance, any sort of surveillance system couldn't really see that unless you were following all people around at all times anywhere near them. So it's very hard to try to surveil the system. So that's one of the things that makes it private is the fact that it's local. So the communication is just done directly between the two devices. So what they'll do is you could send out a random number. So that signal, you could see what is the signal strength coming from Bluetooth from another device. And that gives you an assessment of how close it is. And then in addition to signal strength, the way that we've set it up is each of the phones sends out a random number that's changing all the time. So it changes every few minutes. With the Google Apple APIs, it's longer than that, but it changes enough so that it's not attached to that device or person. And so it changes randomly, and that's kind of what makes it anonymous in the end. And I'll explain how the systems that are not anonymous are a little different. But the way that ours works, you now see the signal strength, the phone itself sees the signal strength of another phone, and it sees that random number. And if you're around another phone for about 15 minutes with a certain signal strength, meaning it's pretty close to you, then that means that the two phones have been near each other. And what they'll do is they'll log locally, and this is not in the database yet, it's just on the phone. So write down, the phone will just record, this was a random number that was seen at this time. And this was also my random number that I was sending out at the time. And so as you interact with more people and as shelter in place is lifted and that number of people increases. Right now, it's 0 to 1 or very small for most people. But as we go back out again, then you would generate a log of the people that, the log of these random numbers that you've seen, which aren't attached to identity or anything. And later, if somebody comes down with COVID-19 or reports that they're positive, that list of random numbers on their phone would be shared with other phones. So it goes up to a database so that you could share that with other phones. And the other phones can check and see, do I recognize any of these numbers? Did I see them before? And if you've seen it before, then you know that you were exposed significantly, and then you send the alert. So that's how the decentralized technology works. So it's mostly everything is stored locally. If you never get COVID-19, that data is never shared with anyone.
Right.
If you do get COVID-19, the data is only a list of random numbers, and that gets shared with other phones.
And so I can say, like, the kind of authoritarian, or even, I mean, I guess it is totalitarian model of this would be, it's either done through GPS or Bluetooth, but when you get a hit where it's, you know, your phone, you've been in close proximity with somebody who has been diagnosed as COVID-19, you will get an alert that says you've been exposed, you must show up at this place for testing by this date. Otherwise, we're going to come get you.
Yes. So,
right. Okay.
Also,
so, I mean, we don't want, that's the privacy concern, kind of in a nutshell.
Yeah, there are a few different ones. One of them is for it to not be voluntary. And like, you must show up by this date. So none of the systems that we've been working with have been involuntary. And so far, none of the countries, even the ones that we're concerned about, have proposed an involuntary version of it. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
The concern is the type of technology that's being proposed. So sometimes they're proposing using GPS. And GPS, like I mentioned before, is very identifying. So you're collecting identifying information about people. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to avoid that. And that's why we chose Bluetooth. However, Bluetooth can be used using these random numbers like I've described, or a system can be built not using random numbers. Instead, there's a giant ID database, and instead of a random number being shared by your phone, there's a database that associates that number to you, your phone number or something else, so that now also Bluetooth is made identifying. So the way that we've avoided that is by creating a protocol that sends out only random numbers. Mm-hmm. And as long as a protocol like that is used, then it can't be co-opted for surveillance.
And this this capability for Bluetooth, like for phones to be kind of handshaking with one another, I guess that might be an outmoded term by this point, but that capability already exists, right? And it's really existing laws or regulations do not allow phones to kind of interact with that level of kind of slipperiness, right? Or ease of function.
So right now it could be done on Android easily. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing that prevents it.
Yeah.
And then Apple had a longstanding, actually there's a battery policy more than a privacy policy that prevented that sort of communication because it would have to be running Bluetooth in the background. Mm-hmm. So this actually doesn't require any changes to existing laws or regulations in order to use.
And the capability is there.
System we could have had before, we just had no reason for it because COVID-19 wasn't around. And the team that we ran into was hoping to use something like this for like the regular flu, for like alerting your friends. So they would know sooner, things like that. And they were like designing a grassroots version of this.
And all of this is, I mean, it's also predicated upon and this is a very different topic, but having a testing kind of protocol and practice up in place that's really robust to begin with.
You mean the testing for COVID-19?
Yes. Yeah.
So you definitely need for there to be widespread testing for something like this to work. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll miss too many of the positive cases.
So, right. So how is your setup distinct from the kind of Apple and iOS collaboration that's going on?
So our team started in early March. And the decentralized protocol was invented by one of the researchers in our group, James Petrie, at the University of Waterloo. So we were the first team to publish first just a regular blog post about it in early March on the 8th. And then on March 20th, we published a white paper online talking about this decentralized model that we were very excited about because it's even more private than GPS, which people already share. So it's sort of like even less than most people are already doing. So we were very excited that it's possible to build something like this and started talking about it and building it and open sourced a protocol that performs this sort of anonymous communication. Mm-hmm. And there are other teams that we were working with, for example, like Singapore and other groups like MIT and other teams that were in our channels as well, that were all kind of thinking about what are the private ways to do this. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were asking the same questions. And some people have taken different directions, like Singapore went in the direction of building a centralized model. So we no longer have
to agree. Can you talk a little bit about that? That program is called, or their app is called Trace Together, the system.
So Singapore is called.
And you had been collaborating with them in terms of, I guess, sharing information and working towards a common goal.
Yeah.
And you've backed out partly because it's not that voluntary there? Or what was the sticking point?
So we took separate paths. So the difference between our privacy models is we built a decentralized one, and they went with a centralized model that collects that has a central ID database. So there's some ways that it's a similar protocol in terms of the technology, because they use Bluetooth. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of similarities, but they went in a different direction in terms of privacy that we disagree with. There's sort of a worst case scenario where that's even worse than Singapore. So they did make some steps to make it a little bit private, where not everyone's information is collected. So they didn't do the worst case scenario. So they made some effort towards privacy, but they still have a central ID database, which we disagree with. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
But now I've read that Singapore has less than 20% penetration of its people so far. And that's under, Singapore is certainly not China, but it is, it's a much more authoritarian country and culture than I think we have in the United States. If they can only get to 20%, is that enough, or is that a sign that, in an actual free country or something approaching a free country, that you won't get enough people to sign up?
So there were a lot of privacy concerns when they released their app in Singapore. So we think that even though a lot of people want a system like this and want an anonymous version of it, if somebody comes out with a surveillance enabling version, like Singapore's, then we don't expect that there will be high adoption. So what we've seen, so early surveys that we looked at that we didn't do, but other teams had done, was about 60% of people already want something that alerts them. And the thing is that if it's done in the wrong way and it's not anonymous and it collects information about you that's new, it's like people don't want that. And if you're goal is adoption in the end, then also you should be considering privacy implications of what you've designed.
That's interesting. How, what would you say is the kind of market penetration that would get you to a point where the app is really functioning well? We talk about herd immunity from viruses and things like that, and people will talk, it might be 60%, it might be 80% or more of a population that needs to have antibodies to something. Analogously, kind of like what would you need in order for your app to either have a cascade effect where everybody starts using it, or it really is delivering a lot of real-time meaningful information?
So something like this could be very powerful with high adoption. So say everybody had smartphones and it would stop the virus and had the app and used it and followed the guidelines. Mm-hmm. So it would be very fast. So an automated version of this is actually something that could be extremely effective. Mm-hmm. So, but realistically, how many certain number of people have smartphones?
Got to have the Bluetooth on, et cetera. There are some technological or physical limitations, right?
Yeah.
To Bluetooth where it doesn't go through walls that well, it might get, develop false positives or something, but.
Right. And then the virus itself has its own R0, and how much do we really need to have a big effect? So I think our team was wanting to do this kind of study, but we've been working on building the technology and building the app. Mm-hmm. We did a study of this, but we think that Oxford did it a little better. So they did a very thorough analysis, and they have a paper from early April. And after talking to them, the number that we got from them was about 56% of a population would need to be adopting an app like this in order to stop the spread of the virus. So it could still stop the virus, and you don't need 100%. You only need 56%.
Okay.
And numbers lower than that still would slow it down or have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that number goes down over time as more people become immune. So you don't need 100%, which is exciting, but you still need a pretty high number.
Although 56% is pretty good compared. I mean, it's not 100, and it's not even 75. So have you and your team been tested for antibodies and whatnot?
Oh, I haven't done that. No.
No. Okay. I'm curious because, this is, I know myself and a lot of people, I know I want to get tested. I'm in New York, and it's it's difficult to find the places that'll do an antibody test if you don't already have symptoms, and then scheduling and whatnot. And then there's, you know, it seems like there's increasing questions about whether or not these tests, how valid they are, how good, you know, how either false negative or false positive they are.
Yeah. So much new technology and new, I mean, in order to respond to this, to COVID-19, there's just been a lot of effort in different directions.
Right.
And I think that on our side, are the challenges that we face right now, one of them is that because it's a new technology, we need to be able to explain how it works. I think that a lot of people's first reaction to an app like this is, oh no, I don't want, because it sounds like it's a surveillance thing when you first hear about it, before you hear about like the anonymity. And so I think that's generally the correct response, because most states and countries so far have been implementing centralized systems.
Yeah.
And so we've been advocating very strongly for switching to decentralized. And we're hoping that that's the choice that gets made in the US. That way, this data doesn't go to the government. It's just shared with other people that you've interacted with.
Well, it's funny because I think when I first started hearing about this, I was excited by it. And I was thinking, you know, with things like Tor or the Onion Router, the kind of secure web service that you can use, which was partly developed with money from the U.S. government, but in Signal, and there's a couple of products where I just take for granted when the people who are pushing it say, this is completely encrypted, this is completely safe. I have no idea. But, you know, I know a lot of journalists, for instance, love Signal. And we don't really have any idea of whether, you know, it could be going directly into the CIA or the NSA's, computers, for all we know.
So we're open source. I think that's
one
big requirement, like any app.
So that helps.
Open source, because then you're like, your cards are on the table. This is how it works.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody who knows, like anybody who is a programmer, can look at it from anywhere in the world and say, how does this, and sort of evaluate it. So we're hoping that we want more privacy experts and people to vet it, because we're very confident in it. And when people do look at it, who are experienced in this, they get very excited. Because
so that's kind of great that by being transparent, you can actually further the cause of privacy in a really solid way. That's great.
Yeah, so our team specifically, as long as we're transparent, we show everything that we're doing and show how this technology preserves the privacy of the users. Mm-hmm. And us being transparent, we can do a lot to help everybody else to check their information.
You mentioned that you have libertarian leanings or whatnot. Talk a little bit about yourself. You're a mechanical engineer, PhD candidate at Stanford. I read in a profile of you that was put out by a Stanford publication that you should have been finishing your PhD by now. So is this merely, I know what that's like. And I mean, is this just a way of putting off finishing your dissertation and defending it? How did you get interested in this? And, you know, what's your background? Where are you from? And, you know, why are you doing what you're doing?
So I'm from Arizona originally, my family. And right now I'm in Arizona with family during, until things get back to normal. And I used to be an aerospace engineer for several years. I also started out very left-leaning and changed my mind around the time I was 25 and became more libertarian. Still a little bit of
What caused you, or what spurred you to take a fork in the road?
That's a very long story.
Well, you know, we're not going anywhere, right? We're in lockdown, so you can give it can you give an abbreviated version?
The abbreviated version was just reading, I guess. So, like, being influenced by libertarian authors, realizing that a lot of the ways that I was thinking about my worldview sort of conflicted with what I was seeing in reality.
Was it more economics or was it more social and technological? Go ahead.
More social, and that your life belongs to you. Kind of answer, like it's up to you, like what are the things that you want to do, and you don't necessarily have to be I think the ethos that's on the more altruistic side of things can make you feel like you're not in control of your life and that you ought to be doing what other people are telling you to do all the time. And that's something morally correct about that. So it's funny because I'm in this situation now, right now, where I'm working on this project that is in many ways very altruistic.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're on at the COVID Watch website. I mean, you talk about it, I believe, as effective altruism.
Yes. So,
obviously, you know, there will be benefits to you personally and career wise and stuff like this. But, you know, this is something you guys are putting out there, right? You're not, this isn't a money.
Yeah, it's a nonprofit. So, and also most people are volunteers. And I am still, fortunately, Stanford is allowing me to continue to just be on my fellowship for right now. So I'm not making any additional money for it, nor are the other founders. We're all just trying really hard to create this. Yeah, like currently there are about 100 volunteers that are contributing regularly. There's about 500 volunteers in our channel. So none of us have started like a 500 plus volunteer pandemic fighting project software development team before. So it's very challenging. Yeah. And and it started with several, so I had made some friends when I first started at Stanford that were in effective altruism. And I think they just had very good conversations about, so I was studying machine learning. And the original reason why I started hanging out with this group of people, the effective altruists, was that they had really good conversations about AI safety. Mm-hmm. So another concern in the future, there's these effective altruism kind of lists different sort of existential threats, like things that in the future might be very dangerous to society. And one of them is AI safety. And another one is, things like this, or something worse than COVID-19, like an escape or something like that, that really cause even worse damage. So, sort of a group of people who are thinking about those things and trying to, figure out ways that you could personally help. Like, what are the best routes to take? So altruism, but thinking about it through the lens of what is the most effective way to do that, and not just going with how things have been done before, and thinking about sort of the numbers behind things. What has the highest impact? Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed debates with them, and I think I was more when I first started. Since I'm coming from a more libertarian perspective, a bit more subversive in these conversations, and trying to represent this side of things. So it's been a little bit complicated because I think that when I first started this project, it was more like it was to truly, really try to help. So I mean, nobody falls perfectly into this category of I'm a libertarian, but I am also very left leaning, and also would like to help. In whatever way I can. So it's kind of hard to put anybody in a particular category.
Although, a kind of communitarian, I think one of the things that libertarian thinking needs to do is evolve past where it was maybe 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 years ago. And, the idea that you're a libertarian or one can be a libertarian because you care about other people, as opposed to you end up helping them anyway. I think that's an area that it's good to see you and other people kind of marking that territory and kind of working through it, because it makes sense. And I think we might agree that a lot of the times altruism that is based on flawed economics or flawed understanding of human behavior and human preferences is not going to work. So, what do we do to actually help them?
Those are the conversations I'm excited about. Excited to participate in with this effective altruism group, and to sort of debate the different sides of that, talk about how there's this, libertarian can be a pretty big umbrella too. Include a lot more than just...
Is this also, in the world of AI and machine learning and things like that, I watched the season finale of Westworld recently, which was all about, free will and individual autonomy, or autonomy in a world where things seem to be more and more determined either by big data or our genetic makeups or whatever. You know, this is exactly the type of frontier I think we stand on. And it's, you know, when the pandemic started, there were headlines all over the place saying there are no libertarians in a pandemic because everybody wants the government or somebody to come and bail you out. And within a couple of weeks, it was really, maybe there are only libertarians in a pandemic because the governments all over the place have not done a good job of it. And we need the kind of innovation and fast acting change and technological innovation that you guys are actually helping to provide.
Yeah, our team is, we started as an independent research project. We had to get advisors involved. And it started with just a few of us. It's me, one other researcher from Waterloo, co-founder from Australia. So it was very much an independent effort that, I think that's another, and it's another good point, is that this is not coming from it didn't come from big tech or big government, but from like a group of volunteers who started up just in response to the pandemic.
Can you, to wrap things up, can you talk a bit about the timeline? Where are you in the development? Are you developing a specific app that will show up in the Google or Apple store? And if so, when will that be? Or what is the timeline for, you know, bringing all of this to, I don't know if it's right to say to market or to wherever, like, what do we see next? And also, where's the best place for people to go to find out more information?
All right. So one thing that was both very exciting and very sad for us was the Google-Apple announcement in early April that they were coming up with their own protocols. So it's sad because we have to let go of ours. But it's exciting because their protocols we can still use to perform the anonymous messaging. And them coming out with these protocols that enable that mean that these surveillance systems are less likely to be used and more likely that the Apple, Google protocols will be used instead. And those enable anonymous systems. So that was very exciting. So we have to give up our particular protocol, even though we're quite attached to it.
Right.
But what we're switching to is essentially, it's very similar.
Right. And they have the benefit of, basically all phones run on either Apple or Droid, right?
Yeah. So there are things that we don't have control over. Like we can't change, we can't have a system update. On Google and Apple side, there were things that needed to be changed that nobody else could change but them. And so their protocols will be more robust. They'll catch all the connectivity that nobody else could have been able to change. So the timeline for us, so we'll have to use Apple Google protocols and they have requirements. So you have to be working with a regional government or a jurisdiction. So their public health department has to give you a thumbs up. So we'd have to work with a public health department, and that I assume will take a few weeks of back and forth. And so we're at the stage of, we've already built our app, it's done, and we can share that with public health departments, this is what it looks like, and start talking with them. And our talk so far with different departments, lots of people want different things here. There are a lot of people who want more surveillance. There are a lot of people who understand where we're coming from and agree that the anonymous system is the way to go. Sort of a lot of disagreement, and people on all sides are wanting to help. Even the people who are building the surveillance systems, for the most part, they're like, well, we need it because it gives us more information about the virus. And so they have good motivations too. And I think that on our side, we have to put in some effort to tell them in order to do that, you have to build the central ID database. It contributes to surveillance. A lot of people, if you're going to build a voluntary system, won't want to sign up for that. And so we have a lot of work to do on our side to make those arguments. And it helps that Google and Apple's protocols came out because now people are pointing more to those and realize that that's what needs to be used. So some of that has already been, that's helped us a lot in making our case. And our timeline is a few.
When do you think you'll have something that's kind of a bad phrase, but has escaped your lab and is out in the wilds doing what it's going to do?
So an app that's in the state. But I think we'd start with a pilot somewhere because of the fact that there's no decentralized system that's been used yet in any state or country. So I think that it's important to pilot on a small scale first and to see what the response is to that. and maybe pilot in a few different places and try a few different things and see what's the best way to go about it. And then
when do you think that might happen?
Hopefully in the next few weeks. And then at a state level, a few weeks after that.
Great. And where should people go to, to get your news as it's happening?
So our website is COVID-watch.org. And we have our, where we're at in the news and how it works and a pretty good description of the technology. And our original white paper is there too. The first publicly available description of technology like this.
Yeah. Great. We will, listeners can also find that in the text at reason.com/podcasts. Tina White, I want to thank you very much for speaking with Reason, a graduate student at Stanford who is pioneering an attempt to come up with a trace app that actually preserves and possibly, we could argue that it actually increases privacy. Tina, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much, Nick. I appreciate it.
And this has been the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast and Reason's other podcasts by going to reason.com/podcasts. Check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum debates, as well as this, the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening.